Yeah, sure. We're gonna help you build a Yahoo clone. And the lead developer fell sick. We were using a bunch of new different technologies, and I, looked around and no one else was there to step up. And so I stepped up and I worked what I consider crazy hours, certainly the craziest of my career. I think I clocked it one week. I worked 96 hours. And as you can imagine, I wasn't super effective, but I mean, I got it done. And they gave me, we had a little launch party, and I'll give you a little quiz here. What do you think they gave me in terms of thanks? Do you think they gave me a $5,000 bonus? Do you think they gave me a nice dinner out? Or do you think they gave me a six pack of beer and a t-shirt?
Hello and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast bringing you the making of stories of successful software developers to help you on your upcoming journey. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Dan Moore. Dan has tasted most of what our industry has to offer: large and small companies, startups, individual contribution, management, communities, writing, and, well, much more. But I'll stop right there because he's about to tell us his story in a minute. Dan, welcome to Dev Journey.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The show exists to help the listeners understand what your story looked like and imagine how to shape their own future. So let's go back to your beginning, shall we? Where would you place the start, the beginning of your developer's journey?
Two words for you: mail merge. So my parents had an insurance brokerage when I was growing up, and one of the things that we had to do was notify people when their insurance policy was due, right? Because they expire every year. And legally, we had to do this. And the first couple of times that I was involved, basically, we were cutting and pasting a bunch of Word documents. It was actually WordPerfect back in the 90s, a bunch of WordPerfect documents over and over again. And I had played around a little bit with Logo in my elementary school days, but I said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so I ended up building a little database and doing a mail merge to generate all of these documents that were legally required. And, it was the most fun I had. It was a lot more fun than stuffing envelopes or doing cut and paste. And it really showed me the power of software, even relatively simple software, to reduce toil and reduce human misery, even in this very small sphere. And that hooked me. And that was where I would place my developer's journey starting.
I guess that's the first time I hear the words mail merge and fun used in the same sentence. But okay. I see your point. Mail merge is a pain in the ass, but not having mail merge and having to do it per hand is even worse. So I'm with you on that one. And I'm still trying to do some mail merge with MS Word sometimes. And what doesn't work, it just doesn't work.
It's going to be around for another 1,000 years, I expect, as long as we're sending letters, for sure. No, it'll be around.
That is true. That is true. So, but you said you've been doing some Logo programming before. So that was in junior high school or high school, or was it? How did you come to?
Even in elementary school. I mean, so Logo. Ooh, okay. Are you familiar with Logo? It's like a turtle and like drawing pictures.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah. So I mean, basically, it was like drawing a star, drawing triangles, like just playing around with the computer. I was lucky to have access to computers pretty early in my life.
Okay, but that was kind of part of your curriculum?
Gosh, I think we had like a special. Like, it was like gym was one day, and then like going to the computer lab was another day, where you would just get like go there and in third grade or whatnot and play around with it. Yeah.
Okay. And then you had a computer at home?
Yeah. I definitely remember having one around fifth grade. I don't know if we had one before then, but that's where I learned about WordPerfect and Macros and all that fun word processing stuff.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get into that?
How did I get into it? I honestly don't remember. It probably was, I definitely remember having to write some reports, and that was probably how I got into it. And then WordPerfect had this thing where you could like shift modes, right? So this was back in kind of DOS. And so you would actually, there was like a way where it was kind of, it was maybe what you see is what you get, but then there was another way where you could see the code. So it was like a, you know, tag, almost like HTML tags for around bold stuff and like italic stuff. And that was just fun to switch back and forth. And then that led to like macros, which were kind of recording of bits of text. So you wouldn't have to type a whole thing. You could just type a couple letters. And that led me on to just kind of understand the basics of the word processor at that point. So
at what point did you have the feeling that you were going from the user perspective to the creator perspective?
I mean, I think when I showed my parents the database, and they're like, holy cow, right? And that was really empowering for me, because I think I might have been in the ninth grade. And, you know, at that age, you can't really do a lot that your parents can't do. But this definitely felt like something that they'd never thought about doing. They weren't really, I mean, they used computers for word processing and accounting, but they had never thought about creating a database. And so that was probably the moment when I was like, wow, you know, programming is, you know, or I don't even know why I thought of it as actual programming, but like, this was pretty cool, like to be able to do this.
Did you have any idea back then that this could become your future?
You know, honestly, I don't think so. Like I kind of, when I, skipping ahead a few years, when I was going to college, I actually picked a college based on wanting to be a writer, and like a science fiction writer. And I don't think that I ever thought that software engineering would be a 20-year career for me, 20 plus. Mm-hmm.
So how did you go from science fiction writing to science fiction programming?
Yeah. I had an internship after my freshman year of college where I was working with a family friend who was in charge of some software, the software department of a public school system. And so we were actually putting stuff on disks and sending stuff out to teachers and other members of the community who wanted to dial up and dial into the modems and use Netscape Navigator. And we were doing some of that. And then also there was like some, they had a Solaris box, or SunOS actually, it was before Solaris, SunOS box. And there were some log files that he wanted me to parse. And he tells the story to my parents, which kind of makes me blush a little bit, but he said he gave me this task expecting me to take it, you know, about a month or a couple of months and keep me busy throughout my internship. And then I read the Perl book, because I was using Perl probably 4 to parse these log files. And I came back in a week just eager for more. And, again, probably eager for more in Perl, and never been used in the same sentence either in your podcast. But, and then I started to do, I stayed in, I did an internship my sophomore year, and that was like a pure physics internship where I was working with a professor of mine at school, and it was very experimental. And I just realized how much fun I wasn't having. Experimentation labs were never really something I enjoyed. And so I ended up getting a job as a proctor at the at the computer lab at college. And I wrote some stuff there. And then I got another internship where I was kind of combining physics and writing software, writing applets for visualization of physics to help with education. And then I ended up doing a senior thesis that was, again, it was supposed to be a physics problem, but it really was like a distributed computational problem that I was working with Java and remote something interface, RMI, whatever that is, that lets you kind of communicate between different Java processes running on different computers. And by that point, I was like, wow, that's really, really, this is something that I'm enjoying, is something I'm fairly good at. And then I end up getting an internship after college back in my home state. And, you know, that was at a small consulting company. And that was, after that, it was kind of off to the races. So that was kind of like when I knew that software development was, you know, lucrative. I'm not going to pretend I'm not attracted to the money, but it's also really intellectually stimulating. People care about you and I found that most people care about employees in a way that doesn't necessarily happen in other professions. And then, you know, the biggest thing to me is that there's always something new to learn. So, those are kind of the reasons why I, kind of took those steps.
So if I got this right, you kind of fought against it. It was there in your life already, and you went in a different way in college, and you had some internships that were hinting at this way again, and you didn't choose it. And then in sophomore years again, and only in your senior years were you really deep into Java and processes, and it really started to smell a lot like computer sciences. And then in your next internship, That was it. Did I get that right?
We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step-by-step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Fight against it might be a little bit of a strong term. I mean, I guess I would say that I explore other options, but you know how it is when, you've talked to a lot more people about their journeys than I have. You know, I think that there are things that I try to do that are against the grain, that even if I know I need to be good at them, it takes like a lot of practice. And then there are things that I do that are kind of with my grain, and software development just turned out to be one of those things. And physics wasn't, right? I mean, I really enjoyed the first couple of years of physics. And then after we got into some of the either the more lab heavy stuff or the stuff that was a little more esoteric, that I just didn't see myself being a professor, and I didn't see myself being a researcher. And it's hard to find a job in physics if you're not willing to do one of those two things. So
that is true.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did you go and get your first job in IT?
Yeah. So I actually, and this is something that I think, I hope we can come back to, but the power of like networks, and and not like software networks, sorry, like people networks, is so important to me in my career. And I've seen it be important to other people's careers. So I did that internship where I was, using Perl to parse log files and helping people install Netscape Navigator. And that person's name was Dave, Dave Bain. And he had worked with a consulting company up in Boulder, Colorado. And so when I was looking for a job, I asked Dave, hey, do you know anybody who's looking to hire software developers? And he introduced me to that consulting company, which was called Xor, which was super formative. And I can talk more about like the ways it was formative for me and how it's still that experience. Those 3 years there has really reverberated throughout my career. But I talked to the director of engineering there. I remember because it was kind of May, and they actually helped support the website for the Kentucky Derby at the time. And so he was a little bit preoccupied and a little bit busy, but he found time to chat with me, and he hired me as an intern for $10 an hour. And so I was there. I moved back to Colorado, and I moved into a place up in Boulder, and I was there. And 3 weeks in, he pulled me into the office and said, "Hey Dan, do you want a full-time job?" And threw out a number, $42,000, that was bigger than I had ever, thought of, because I was used to working these $10, $12 an hour jobs in the late 90s. And so I said, heck yeah, right? Because it wasn't just the money again. It was the team that I was with. It was the problems we were solving. I was learning something every day. And this was in 99, so kind of dot-com craziness. And so, we had something fun every Friday. I was going out with a set of people and like building a real like set of friendships. And the coding was fun too. So,
yeah. Let's talk about it. You said those were three very formative years. In which way?
Yeah. So I think they were formative in good and bad ways, right? Because I think both kinds of experiences can really help you. I definitely saw how teams could work together to accomplish things. I definitely saw how executives can come in and it gave me a little bit of cynicism around executives. Although as I've gotten further along in my career, I have more compassion for the choices they were faced with, right? I mean, in 99, they were talking about opening offices. It was a 500 or 600 person company. In 99, they were talking about opening offices in London and Singapore. And in 2001, they were laying people off, right? So they had to make some hard choices. One lesson that really, you know, that I talk about all the time is there was a situation where I was on a small team, a couple of developers. We were delivering for a client because it was a consulting company, right? So very project-based work. We'd sell something and then we would staff it up and then we would build the thing and send it off. And then they would operate it, although we tried to help them operate it. And they came in and they wanted to build a Yahoo clone. And this was back when Yahoo was sexy and exciting. And so we said, yeah, sure. We're gonna help you build a Yahoo clone. And the lead developer fell sick. We were using a bunch of new different technologies. And I, you know, looked around and no one else was there to step up. And so I stepped up and I worked what I consider crazy hours, certainly the craziest of my career. I think I clocked it one week. I worked 96 hours. And as you can imagine, I wasn't super effective, but I mean, I got it done. And they gave me, we had a little launch party, and I'll give you a little quiz here. What do you think they gave me in terms of thanks? Do you think they gave me a $5,000 bonus? Do you think they gave me a nice dinner out? Or do you think they gave me a six pack of beer and a t-shirt?
I would go for the latest.
Yep. And that's what they did. And that just drove home to me. Like I saved them. I don't know what would happen if we defaulted on our contract, but in my mind, at least, I had really kind of pushed the boundaries of my health and, you know, certainly my expertise to deliver this project. And they basically, you know, said, well, here you are, you know, thanks, but, you know, they gave me a token, right? And that just taught me that a company is never going to value your time as much as you do. And there's nothing wrong with putting in a hard day's work, and there's nothing wrong with working more than you might be expected to, but don't expect anything from the company. Like, just do it because you want to, or do it because you feel you need to. But don't expect anything from the company.
Did you have this experience again in subsequent companies that you worked for?
So I have done since then. I've worked at some consulting shops and some startups. I think the startup is kind of a different category because there you're an owner. And even then, I don't think I ever hit 90 hours a week. A recent consulting company, there were a couple of weeks where I worked 60 or 70, but I was director of engineering. And I did that with my eyes wide open. I said, you know, I know that what I can expect is like a thank you, and I'm not expecting anything else. I think that's the biggest lesson is just, it's better to set expectations for yourself, and then you're less likely to be disappointed. And that was probably the biggest thing, is I was expecting to be treated more, maybe like a hero, and they didn't want to. And, you know, now that I look back on it, now that I say that, they might have wanted to discourage that kind of behavior. Maybe that was the reason they did it. I don't, or maybe they just didn't know about it. That's probably more likely. But I don't think that long hours ever serve you unless you're building something that you own.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. I'm trying to imagine how I would react with my team if somebody was pulling very long hours like this, and maybe saving the day, but that's clearly not a behavior that I want to encourage. So right. how do you reward somebody for going the extra mile and doing the work, but without making a precedence of a positive precedence out of it?
That's
a thorny question.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would hope that you, certainly if I was in an engineering manager role, I would, I mean, I've actually done this. I've actually told people, hey, stop working so much, right? Or do this if you want to, but realize that these are the ramifications. And I kind of wish a manager had pulled me aside and said, hey, Dan, thanks for doing that. But really, you know, we can see that's wearing on you. We can see you're tired and your life isn't, you know, don't spend your life for this company. But yeah. That's kind of depressing now that I say that.
Life stories and learnings that quite often you have to live through before you can really understand what it means.
But I mean, so the plus side of being at XOR, at that consulting company, is that I've gotten a number of jobs from people I've met there. I have, I'm still friends with people that I've met there. It was a real, not that particular 96-hour week thing, but the rest of the experience, the dot-com experience, being exposed to a bunch of different technologies, Perl, Java, version control, DocBook, all kinds of interesting things that maybe aren't as interesting now as they were in the early 2000s. I always recommend, if people don't know, when new developers talk to me, if people don't know what they're going to do, I think small consulting shops are great places to start, because you'll be exposed to a wide variety of business domains and technology domains. And if you get on a project you hate, you're going to be moved off it in not that long a period of time. And because it's small, it's actually going to, like, what you do actually matters, right? Like, the fact that I did that 96-hour week actually mattered to the company, as opposed to you go work for Deloitte and they'll still want you to work those hours, but it doesn't, you don't have that quite visceral, like, feedback loop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You mentioned that. That's probably some kind of a fast forward for me, but I'll do it anyway. You mentioned a position of director of engineering when we're talking about engineering management. So how did you go from a developer or an individual contributor to learning how to be a consultant, and then dipping your toes into maybe team leading, and then going to management, then leading a whole department, and then going back to founding? How did you jump from one position to the other and learn how to do this?
So your question is, how did I learn how to be a manager, or how did I learn how to transition between these different kinds of roles?
The latest. So how to transition and be a jack of all trade, or be what you need to be at that point?
Sure. I mean, so I would say that both of the times I did management, I it was an internal promotion. And so that I find is a lot simpler than going to be, being an IC at company A and moving to, like, management in company B. So I've taken two swings at engineering management. I'm not sure that I'm cut out to be an engineering manager, because both times I had pretty good support from above. And I had some time to, read and some time to learn. I mean, I think I tweeted this recently, that engineering management and being an engineer, a software engineer, are about as similar as American football and regular football, right? Soccer. there's goals in both ones. They're both played on a field, so there's overlap, but they're definitely disparate skill sets. And I 100% respect the great engineering managers that I've interacted with, and great product managers and whatnot, but it's a whole different set of skills, and so I basically picked them up ad hoc. I will say that I, unfortunately, in both those situations that I was an engineering manager, the teams were small enough and the companies were small enough that, and this is the downside for working for a small company, is that I had to be a player coach, and I feel like that doesn't give you as much time nor as much incentive in some ways to focus on getting really good at this new skill, right? This people management skill, because you still need to dip your hands back in the code and, like, deliver code instead of really focusing on building up your team members. I feel like I'm wandering a little bit. I guess specifically what steps I would take to learn a new role is, reach out to people who are currently in that role and ask them questions, lean on them for guidance. Usually you can find some great books, especially around something as well-known as engineering management. I joined the RANS Leadership Slack, which is, there's a great author called Michael Lopp, who's written a blog called RANS in Repos. And he's basically built this group of over 10,000 engineering managers or former engineering managers. And that's been, when I was a managing manager, that was helpful to me, because I could ask there if I had difficult questions.
You created your own company, right? And how did that relate to being a manager? That's kind of the same skill set, I would assume.
It's actually, I found it to be, the company that you're referring to, I founded in 2016. It was called The Food Corridor, and fantastic experience. I was there for a couple of years. My co-founder had the idea, and I was the engineer. And, you know, when you're a startup, you can hand out titles like candy, right? Like CTO is definitely like the default engineering title. But I actually wrote a blog post called Founding Engineer or Founding CTO. And as you grow as a company, the CTO role becomes more and more like what a real CTO does, right? A CTO of like a big company is really shouldn't be touching code very much at all. Maybe they're doing code reviews or working on non-critical features, but they are talking about strategy. They're really interfacing with the business. They might be doing recruiting. What I was at the Food Corridor was really like a hands-on CTO, and I was really a founding engineer. And if I'd stayed at the company, it's possible I could have grown to be the CTO. But you know, when we first started the company, it was two people. It was me and my co-founder, right? And so I was, you know, she wasn't going to write any code because she wasn't technical. She could give UX feedback, and she ran user interviews and really was the domain expert. And I was really responsible for kind of taking her product vision and implementing it. So I would say that being a startup CTO, especially of a one or two or three person startup, is really nothing. You're not going to use too many skills other than like being able to talk to customers that you would if you were a director of engineering at a bigger company.
I see. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah, no worries.
You worked for Oracle at some point, didn't you?
So as a contractor, I should be careful.
As a contractor, okay.
Yep, I was a contractor.
In a few sentences, how was it to work for such a giant company after or in between smaller ones or tiny ones?
It was weird, man. I mean, it's a different world, you know, in terms of, so there's like the bureaucracy side, and I'll try to keep this brief. You know, as far as I understand it, like I was just a contractor being hired, and the office of the president of Oracle, like Larry Ellison's office, had to sign off on me being hired. And that level of bureaucratic control felt really weird. At the same time, the technology opportunities to work there were just, you know, leaps and bounds above what you get at a small company. The piece that I was working on was doing like kind of reconciliation of offline and online advertising audiences, and just dealing with like tremendous volumes of data and traffic in a way that I had never seen before. So that was really the exciting piece, but the bureaucracy was a little bit nuts.
I would tend to believe so. That's exactly what I would expect. Yeah. Okay. Before time runs out and we don't talk about it, I would like to segue into the book you're finishing or finished already. And could you give us the pitch for the book and then the origin story and how it emerged and how you got to writing this? Because I think that's a really interesting story in there.
Great. Yeah, sure. So the pitch for the book is, this is a set of basically letters to developers that are organized by theme and will be kind of bite-sized bits of advice that you can read whenever you want and will help you become a better developer, a better team member, a better developer, and a better able to progress in your career. So that's kind of the pitch for it. And I had written a book about a particular technology, Apache Cordova, in the early 2010s. And it was a 40-page ebook and tremendous effort and super fun to have written. And then we immediately stopped using that technology at my company. And I said, I'm never going to do that again. I really enjoy writing a book, but I don't want to write a book about a technology, because technologies, unless you are like immersed in them, and as you mentioned, I've kind of jumped across different technologies in my career. Unless you're immersed in them, then the book either becomes something that you maintain out of like a passion, or it just gets old and doesn't do anybody any good. So I started to look around and see what was something that was evergreen that would be interesting for me to write. And I have this theory that you shouldn't write a book unless you can write 10 great blog posts. And so I started a blog, and basically I blogged for about a year and a half before I even talked to anybody about possibly publishing the book. And basically I was writing 1 to 2 posts a week and sharing them around, seeing whether they're resonating. And then finally got to the point where I kind of talked to a publisher about it briefly, and I'd never worked with a book publisher. The previous book was self-published, and people were like at meetups were saying, "Hey Dan, thanks so much for your advice." And you know, I shared this with other people, my blog, and that just really struck home to me that, hey, you know, maybe this is worth spending the time and effort to actually turn it into a real book. Yeah, so that's kind of the origin story.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples of those letters, of the topics you addressed? Is it all squishy soft skills, or do you go deep into some tech anyway, or are you still more in the architectural and cross-cutting concerns of programming and stuff? How should the listeners picture that?
Great question. So it's primarily soft skills, which I think is a horrible name. I think that I find them pretty hard, and I know that some other developers too. I do jump into like some tooling where I feel like it's evergreen. So stuff like version control systems. I'm not going to give you the in-depth of you know, partial file adding on Git or anything like that. I'm going to say you should learn a version control system because these are the things that will help you do, or debugging. Or I talk a little bit about JQ, awk and sed, because I think those tools have been around for decades and will be around for decades more. But no, I mean, some of my most popular posts are, one is avoid working alone, where I talk about how if you are like, and again, my audience is primarily newer developers, people under 5 years of experience. If you're kind of a new developer and you get pulled into a company where you're one of, you know, a very few technical people or possibly the only technical person, you're going to have a way harder time progressing than if you go into a company that has a team of developers that you can learn from. That was one of my popular posts.
That's an interesting one, the word avoid working alone. If you can avoid it, then fantastic. Then you have people around you. But what if you can't? What advice would you give to developers, maybe newer developers that find themselves in such a context with not many people around them, or people they cannot completely use as mentors or as stepping stones? What would you advise them?
Yeah, it's a great question, because you're right. Sometimes you just, especially in this job market, I don't know how it is in Europe, but like there's a ton of people call them junior developers, I call them new developers on the market. Sometimes you just have to take what you can get, right? And so in that case, I would 100% do a couple of things. One is I would keep your resume up to date, because after you have a year of experience, you're going to find it much easier to find a different job. But I would also reach out to other communities, right? And we live in a world that is interconnected. So there are online communities. Hacker News is maybe not the friendliest one, but it's definitely out there. And there are other ones like that. And then there are offline communities, meetups. And again, this depends on where you live, right? There are definitely places that don't have great meetups. But if you can go to a local meetup, and especially if you go there multiple times, you can start to like be integrated in the community. And at that point, you can start to ask questions about, hey, we're doing it this way at my current company. Is this kind of a bad idea? Frankly, honestly, right now with COVID, most meetups are online. So those are kind of the things I would do if I were a new developer right now and I was stuck working alone.
Mm-hmm. That comes back to the comment you made at the beginning, talking about networking, mm-hmm. and how important that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and so just put some numbers on that. I think I did some, I think I've had 8 or 9 jobs in my career, like full-time W-2 jobs. And I'd say half of them have been found through my network. And I would say the older I get, the more that happens. I'd also say that like my contracts, I think I've had 10 or 20, what I consider to be long-term contracts, and 60 or 70% of those came through people I'd worked with. So if I had one piece of advice to give to new developers, I'd say don't look down your nose at LinkedIn, because LinkedIn's a Rolodex. My friend says this is a Rolodex that other people keep updated, and you can, you know, people interviewing is hard enough. Like if you can get a power up by interviewing someplace where somebody already knows you, it's going to make things so much better.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I was looking at some job offers on or job postings on LinkedIn a couple of days ago, and seeing there they have a new system to allow you to apply directly, and there they have an estimation of how many people applied already. And all the jobs, I made this comparison and looking at into this, the jobs that specifically post as remote jobs versus the non-remote ones, and there's really a factor 10 between the two of them.
10x.
So it's a 10x. So the jobs that have a remote flag, they get something like 200, 300 plus applications in a couple of days nowadays. So there's absolutely no chance for you to get in there without a bit of networking. It's I'm really wondering how HR departments are going to handle this, or companies trying to hire are going to handle this in the future when we're going more and more remote. Recently, I heard from Basecamp that they have multiple thousand applicants for each position they publish, which is absolutely nuts.
Yeah. I mean, how do you even, like, you can't give everybody a fair shake, right? Like, so you have to like start to do these, like the resume, like just like throw the resumes into the trash pile as quickly as you can, right? Or like find any factor that would cause you to throw them out, which is, that's horrible for, I mean, it's horrible for everybody, right? But I don't know what the answer is. Yeah.
I don't either. I'm really, that was the problem I was thinking about was on while I was driving. Yeah. I was like, how would I solve this problem? I have absolutely no idea. From an applicant perspective, yeah, networking and trying to get there, or trying to show your work before you can apply, but applying directly for a position, I think it's in the past.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. That may be the answer. Is like you're going to have to make. It used to be that it was hard to apply for a job, right? Because you had back in the 80s, you had to like find the job and like mail something in, and now it's very, very easy. And so and the job boards have every incentive to make it easy, right? Because that's how they keep things going. But I think companies are gonna have to make it harder, right? And you can make it harder during the interview process, and or you can make it harder before the interview process. But I guess then one thing I would like to say is I think that the unfortunate truth is the back channel networking, right? And you being able to hand your resume to somebody you've worked with before is great if you've had a chance to work with somebody before, but it really closes the door on a lot of talented people. And that's one of the reasons I started the blog, is that I wanted to help new developers avoid mistakes I made and get better quicker. And I still want to help them. I don't know how to help them go into my network, except where I do let people like that I meet at a meetup. I say, hey, go ahead and check me on LinkedIn and look at people that I'm connected to that are in companies that you're interested in. And I will be happy to do an intro for you. It won't be like, hey, I've worked with person ABC and they're awesome. It'll be more like, hey, I met this person at a meetup. They seemed cool. At the very least, that's something that I can offer to like help try to break down that network.
Well, when you can do that, that's very helpful. But how would you, maybe you've done this before, how do you handle the balance between pushing somebody and saying, hey, yeah, I met this person, he or she sounds cool, maybe that's somebody that could work for you, without involving yourself too much and putting too much of your reputation on the line? How do you handle this balance? See what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a really tough thing. I mean, I think that the answer is that, and I've definitely made the mistake before of going to bat for people in some different contexts in a way that they was kind of too much, right? I mean, I think that what you want to do is you want to have equilibrium between how much effort you expend for someone and how well you know them and how much effort they expend. And so lots of times, in fact, the thing I just told you, right, where I say, hey, people, look on my LinkedIn profile and see whether you see anybody at companies that you're interested in, and I'll be happy to intro you. Like, I've made that offer tens of times, and I think I've been taken up on it once or twice because people, you know, don't want to put in the effort to do that, right? So I think if you can put a few little like steps in the way, then the people who are really focused on it will help. But I have found that, like, you know, just when you do the intro, being clear about how you know the person, and especially with kind of newer developers, I think newer developers are hired more for potential than they are for kind of expertise. And so maybe a little more of a pass, or maybe, you know, knowing that someone is good, you know, is an interesting person to talk to, and they've been to a couple of meetups, is enough of a qualification. I haven't tried to do that with more senior people as often.
Do you have any tips or tricks for newcomers on how to network better?
Yeah. So I think that, so there's a couple pieces, right? When I already mentioned joining the community, right, and actually being involved in the community, I saw a new developer actually step up and help organize a meetup, because honestly, organizing a meetup is not hard. It's hard work, but it's not complicated, right? All you need to do is volunteer for something, and you can find speakers, or you can like run a meeting, which, you know, is terrifying the first couple times you do it, but afterwards it gets easier. So I think volunteering is a great way to do it. I think also even just practicing networking conversations. And I think that one key thing that I've learned over my years is that people love to talk about themselves. Thank you for having me on. and so in any kind of conversation that I have where I'm talking to strangers, I try to give people information about me that they might want to ask questions about, or try to get information about them, right? So I might say something like, you know, I've worked with A, B, C, and D. You know, what have you worked on lately, right? And so give people real conversational, like, hooks is what I call them, because otherwise I find that it can be too easy to kind of just, and this, again, I'm wistful for this now, but it can be too easy to stand around and just eat your pizza at a meetup and not actually engage in conversation. So be interested in other people. And then the other kind of piece of advice I would give is do the follow-up, do the work, right? Like, no one is going, I mean, some people might help you out of goodness of their heart, but even then, you can help them help you. An example of this is I was getting an introduction to a possible employer a couple months ago, and the person doing the intro said, hey, can you write this up for me? And you should write up something that says why the company's awesome, why you're awesome, why you'd be awesome at the company, and put it, and I might modify it a little bit, she basically said, but I'm going to send this on to them. And that made me really think, and that was extra work that I had to do. And again, if I hadn't been interested in the company, I might have just said, ah, no, thank you, or ghosted her, which would have been even worse. But, you know, doing those extra steps of effort will differentiate you, because it is actually astonishing to me how easy it is to differentiate yourself. You just have to put in a little bit more effort.
Yeah, that's very important. Thank you for saying that. The showing up is really part of the success. We tend to minimize this impact, but by showing up, you're already doing a lot of things, or a lot more than the rest of the bell curve. Mm-hmm. And so then you can start to fight for the best places in big air quotes, or the better recommendation or better networking. But already being there, it's already very, very, very effective. That's all. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. And one networking trick I would like to add, and I try to place this once in a while because it was so forming for me, is asking people for referrals related to a special topic. So for instance, I was I'm very interested in mentoring, and I've done this countless time at conferences or meetups, is getting to someone and asking who here in the room would be interested in talking to me about mentoring. I'm new here, I know nobody. Do you have any idea who I should be talking to? And this is very effective, because it doesn't lock the person into the discussion. If the person is indeed interested in mentoring, then they will start talking to you. But they have a very easy open door to close the discussion, meaning, I don't know anyone here either. Or you can go talk to Bob, and then off you go. And they're they're free, and they don't have to talk to you. And this has worked so, so well for me. Having this this question, this open question, where people can really decide if they want to engage in the discussion or not, and that helped me do some cold introductions to people and start the talking stuff.
So when you say cold introductions, do you mean that like the person will be like, you should really talk to Bob, and then they'll pass on to Bob, or is it more the cold introductions to the person you ask the questions of?
Both of those. The first things, for instance, I remember I was invited in Poland, and I didn't speak the language, and I was the only non-Polish speaker there. And it was kind of hard to get to start a discussion. And so I used this trick. I went to one of the organizers and say, hey, apparently I'm one of the only non-Polish speakers here. Who should I talk to? And there it worked very fine. He started being interested in what I was interested in. And so we talked for a couple hours together. And then he pushed me towards somebody else and say, hey, now you should really talk to this other person. And I would never have known that this person was there and that he was interested in this case. He was interested in this topic. And so I got both and some kickstart to get a discussion going with this organizer, and then some help to find the correct person.
That's awesome. I've never used it for filtering people on interests, but it's a great trick for that. I've definitely used it for jobs, because I feel like when you're reaching out to your network and you say, I need a job, to somebody, that, to your point, immediately puts them on the spot. Like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have a job. But if you say, do you know anybody who's looking for my skill set? Again, it's the same kind of thing where it's a soft out. They can either say no, or they can think, or they can say, oh, I am. So
absolutely,
totally agree that that's a, but I'd never thought about using it for interest purposes too. That's great.
And I had never thought of using it for searching a new job. Cool. Thanks as well. Okay. We are kind of reaching the end of the interview. What advice would you have for newcomers in our industry? Maybe one of the top three advices of your book that you really want to give toward people that have less than 5 years of experience.
Yeah. So I would say two things. I would say, first is never stop learning, right? I mean, I'm now doing developer relations at a fusion auth company that is in the identity space. And so I'm learning about identity. I'm also learning about developer relations, because I haven't really done this before. And I think that is a joy and a terror of software engineering or technology as a career, is that you should never stop learning. And that's fun, but it's also, sometimes it gets tiresome, but find ways to always be learning would be one piece of advice. And another one is, I think that there's four things you need to do as a new developer to really stand out. And I've run this by a couple of managers. I'd love to hear your feedback on it too. It's say what you're going to do and then do that, right? So be open about communicating things and then follow through. Ask good questions. And that both means researching, but also it means knowing when to stop researching and spinning your wheels and just ask somebody who's a senior developer or somebody who might know the answer. Handle mistakes well, which means you acknowledge them, you fix them as best you can, and then you learn and don't make the same mistake twice. And then the last one, which you kind of already addressed, is showing up consistently. Like, if you show up consistently every day and you put in a hard effort every day, you will get better. When you're a new developer, I remember when I was a new developer and I was learning, like, even just learning OO, moving from Perl to Java, like it's so hard and you feel so overwhelmed. But if you show up and learn a bit every day, eventually you'll get to the point where things are ingrained in your mind. And I look back on things that I look at things I do now, and I know I would have had a heck of a time doing them 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And now I just do them. So those would be my piece of advice.
That's very wise. So say what you're going to do, do it. Know when to ask questions. Be sure you know how to handle mistakes and show up. Mm-hmm. I would agree. I would be missing one piece, maybe. That would be the reflection piece, and the stopping, thinking back on what you did, and learning from the past, maybe.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, for sure. I mean, I don't know. I had a great guest post on the blog actually that was talking about a journal, and this person who wrote this book journals like exhaustively, and I don't have that experience, but I definitely blog. And that's been one of the ways that I capture things that have happened that I'm like, oh my God, I never want this to happen again. Or I want this to happen again. I write them down in a public way. But you're right. Introspection is definitely, that should be a fifth thing. Thank you.
My pleasure. Well then, where could the listener start a discussion with you, network with you, or find your book? Where should we send them?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter, at MoreDS, MoreDS. And then the blog that was the genesis of this book is letterstonewdeveloper.com. So I'd love to, I have a contact form there, and would love to just ask, answer questions. If you have questions about development, again, don't ask me what kind of React like middleware you should use in a such app. But if you want to talk about like bigger picture developers, like soft skills stuff. And then two, I also am looking for guest posters. So I have had guest posters that have had 20, 30 years of experience. And I've had guest posters that have been a month into their first job. And I think everyone has something to teach and everyone has something to learn. So
thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey. And we'll see each other next week. Bye-bye. This is Tim, speaking from a different time and space. You can get a discount on the pre-order of Dan's book if you go to apress.com and enter the code GiveMeMore08. You can find the link and the code in the show notes. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to the podcast to get the episodes right when they air. And don't forget to tell your friends and coworkers about the podcast. This word of mouth really helps us grow. Thank you very much, and see you next week. Bye.